We are finishing up our class on study of the life of Paul, and this past class we didn't really get to the end of what we were talking about with the second missionary journey, so we'll kind of start off there with this brief overview of kind of the accomplishments of the second missionary journey that Paul was able to do. And of course it was twice as long, as about 3,000 miles approximately. If I don't know how many steps that would be. He probably got more than 10,000 steps a day in his travels. So anyway, so we see here on the board some of his accomplishments, or what was achieved there on this second missionary journey. Paul was able to encourage the churches in various places that they'd been to before, as that was part of what they're trying to do. Also established new congregations. The one in Philippi was a major one. As we're going into Asia now, going into other areas that he had not been previously, meeting up with Silas and Timothy, Luke, also Aquila and Priscilla, and some other people that are prominent in his work. He mentions also Clement, which we'll mention later on in our study this morning. Clement, we'll be mentioning later on. Then also possibly writing books, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, when he was spending some time waiting on Timothy, and then also possibly writing Galatians during this time. There is some discussion about when exactly Galatians, the letter, was written, but it could have been written in this time. So anyway, that's an overview very quickly of some of the things that were accomplished in the second missionary journey. We didn't really get to last Sunday because somebody was talking too much. So anyway, you get to preaching, sorry. But we'll be looking at a summary of the rest of Acts and the life of Paul, and then getting into some other details about his kind of his demise and some things that took place at the end of his life. Spain or no Spain and those kind of things. So we'll be looking at that as well this morning. So as we're going to be starting off basically in Acts chapter 18, kind of going through very quickly some of this information. In his third missionary journey, going into Galatia and Phrygia and into these different regions. Apollos goes also from Ephesus to Corinth and setting things in Corinth. We know about Apollos' influence in Corinth. Why do we know about Apollos' influence in Corinth? Do we read anything later on that the Corinthians say about Apollos? Remember in 1 Corinthians, I am of Paul, I am Apollos. Okay, so he obviously had an influence in the work there in Corinth. And then Paul spends a great amount of time in Ephesus. And there's some interesting things that happened in Acts chapter 19, verses 1 through 7. Is a great passage, especially if you're talking to somebody about baptism. And they say, well, I was baptized as a kid, or I was baptized here, I was baptized. Here's a passage that says, here's some guys who were baptized, but they didn't really know what they were being baptized into or what they were doing with their baptism, and they got rebaptized. So they knew only of John's baptism, which was not the baptism that they needed. And so they were rebaptized in Acts chapter 19. And so he begins teaching the synagogue. We see a lot of the miracles that Paul is doing in Ephesus as his message is being confirmed by the miracles. And then there's an interesting, I really like this story in the seven sons of Sceva, in verses 13 through 17. So in verses 13 through 17, but also some of the Jews, exorcists, who went from the place to place, attempted a name over those who had the evil spirits, the name of the Lord Jesus, saying, I adjure you by Jesus whom Paul preaches. Seven sons of one Sceva, a Jewish chief priest, were doing this. And the evil spirit answered and said to them, I recognize Jesus, and I know this guy Paul, but who are you? And what happens to them? What happens to them? They get whooped, I think is what you know. They get tore up. They get tore up, okay? And this became known to all the people who were living there. And so here is this, the spirit says, I know Jesus, and I know Paul, but I don't know you guys. Which is to say, maybe Paul and Jesus don't know these guys either. So anyway, that's an interesting story about the things that are going on in Ephesus, and that's what's happening while they're establishing or working with that work there in Ephesus. So you see, Paul spent about 3 years there, and so a lot of relationships were built. And we see that come to play later on in his trip. So a repentance summary of the reports that are going on in Asia. How are the churches doing in Asia, according to verse 20? That was so-so, hit or miss. According to verse 20, how are the churches doing in Asia? Mightily, they were growing. That's a good word, right? I like that word. They were growing mightily. So we see the work was going well there in Asia. What happens in 20 and 22? This begins to be kind of an overall theme for the end of the book of Acts. What does Paul relate to the people there in Ephesus? His travel plans, what is he saying? He wants to go to Rome, right? So after these things were finished, Paul purposed in spirit to go to Jerusalem after he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia, saying, "After I have been there, I must also see Rome." And having sent to Macedonia two of those who were ministered to him, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. So he begins telling us about his plans to go to Jerusalem and then go to Rome. And he has his plans, and other people have their plans about what they think should be happening with Paul. And we get information about what's going on in there. But there's a riot breaks out, and so there's all this that's going on about the people fighting against the trade that's going on there. And so what's happening to the business, verse 25? So everybody's converting to Christ, leaving behind idol worship, leaving behind buying these silver statues and that kind of stuff. What begins to happen in verse 25? Well, 24 and 25, rather. They were losing business, right? If what you're doing starts touching people's wallets, do they start paying attention? Really? Yeah. And that's not true today, is it? So here in this situation, it begins to touch your wallet, and there is this crowd is called out, and there's a great rage that's going on because of what's going on, and they had to quiet everybody down. And this individual who kind of goes out into the crowd to quiet them down is very tactful in how he does this. And you see that you need to understand what he's saying is, if you guys don't chill out, you'll get the Roman soldiers in here and they will make you chill. And you will not like it because they were not allowed to have any uprising. They were not allowed to have any kind of, like he's saying, even in this context, that you shouldn't be gathered together in this way. And it's interesting that there's a word used, the crowd that was assembled together. That's the word ekklesia. The word ekklesia that we translate into iglesia, into church, it was a word that was used, it was a common word for any crowd that was called out for a particular purpose. It was not a specific Christian, Bible class word. And so it was just a common word, like baptism. Baptizo was what you would use when you were washing dishes. There were certain words that have become Christian words because we've just kind of transliterated them into and made a new word. But this is a great text that tells you about that particular word. This crowd was a ecclesia that was called out for a particular purpose in this instance. And so you see, everywhere Paul goes, everybody loves him. He never has any kind of trouble, never kind of has any issues, right? Wrong, obviously. He continues to have opposition to what's going on. So we see this journey. As the journey continues, he's in Greece. And we see there in sermon in Troas, Paul's words at Miletus. What does he say? Why is he in Miletus? If you fast forward over to chapter 20, what's he doing there in chapter 20? Do you remember? Specifically 17, what's he doing there? 6, 13 through 38. What is he talking? What is he doing? He calls the elders down from Ephesus. So he doesn't have time. He's in Miletus. He doesn't have time to go up to Ephesus. And so he has the elders come down to him. And he begins to talk to them. And what does he say? What is he saying? What is his message kind of in a nutshell? And why do they begin weeping at the end of his discussion with them? This is in Acts chapter 20, 13 through 38. And say, oh, I'm leaving now, but I'll come back and see you in a couple years, and we'll have a good time then. What is he saying in his message to them? Be careful with what you have been made overseers, right? What else? Shepherd the flock. He warns them about possibly people coming in, even among them, right? Even among the elders. What else does he warn them? What does he say to them? You're not going to see me again. You'll never see me again. How's that to lay on somebody? Last time you'll see me. It's usually not a fun thing to say to anybody. But that's why, you know, he has this you know, weeping as he's leaving. And so we see, again, the time that he spent there and all the things that he did with them when he was there in Ephesus. And he endeared himself to that congregation as... you can imagine the times that they spent with him, the things they were able to see him do, and then not only that, the turmoil that happened. And a lot of times with turmoil, what happens when it's this turmoil without, what happens to the body that are being attacked? They grow closer together, right? You grow closer together through that turmoil, through that conflict. And so that conflict over the silversmiths and that kind of things kind of just solidified all those bonds for that congregation there. And so you can see how he was very dear to them and vice versa. And so him telling them, I'm not going to see you again, is, you know, a hard thing for them to hear as he begins to travel on. And then Paul travels to Caesarea, and time he spends there with Philip. And during this time, along the way, the people that are telling him, don't go to Jerusalem. Don't go to Jerusalem. If you go to Jerusalem, you're going to be bound. If you go to Jerusalem, this is going to happen. Don't go to Jerusalem. Don't go to Jerusalem. But he says, I've got to go. I've got to go to Jerusalem, is his kind of drive at the end of this letter. And it sets in motion a lot of things for Paul and how kind of how his life turns out. So, in Jerusalem, sort of the obviously welcomed by the brethren, and then attacked by the Jews, right? We've expected this. So, if you look in Acts chapter 21, Paul's in Jerusalem. Verse 27, when the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, what does that mean? If somebody in a crowd can pick your face out, what does that mean? Yeah, they know who this guy is. His name's on the milk box, or his picture's on the milk boxes, right? Not because he's lost, but kind of a most wanted kind of individual. Enemy of the state, enemy of the Jewish state as far as... So they see him, and what do the people begin to do? Verse 28, they laid hands on him, and what do they cry out? Well, men of Israel, come to our aid. Look, that's like a battle cry. Men of Israel, come to our aid. We're going to get this guy. What? Why would they be doing this? What's that? Turn people against. What have we seen the Jews do over and over and over and over and over again? Every time Paul goes to a city and good things start to happen, what does the Jewish people begin to do? Stone him. They've been stoning him. They've been trying to stone him again. And they always stir up strife, and even sometimes following him from city to city. And so was it any wonder that if he went to Jerusalem, sort of, you know, obviously Mecca for the Jewish people, that he would have the same sort of issue here? He knew that going into this. And if you look at the text, what do they begin to do with Paul? Verse 31, Yeah, they were not giving him the keys to the city, right? They were going to try and kill him. They were seeking to kill him. A report came to the commander of the Roman cohort, all right? So, again, in the context of the Roman culture, they had to keep this, like, nothing. Like, nothing like this is supposed to happen. And you can imagine if, you know, chickens in a hen house and it's just going crazy. That's what Jerusalem was, and with Paul in Jerusalem, essentially. And so they go in trying to calm everything down because they cannot have this kind of thing. You know, they definitely don't want another Jesus of Nazareth moment with this guy. And so they go in. The commander came and took hold of him, ordered him to be bound with two chains, began asking him who he was, what he'd done. And so the crowd is going crazy. 37, as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to his commander, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek?" And he says, "Then you are not an Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out in the wilderness." But Paul said, "I am a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city. I beg you to allow me to speak to the people." And so he gets permission. So what was the commander trying to determine in that moment? Paul wants to say something. Hey, I want to speak. If somebody asks to speak to a kind of tinderbox moment, kind of like this could just blow up in any second, do you allow just anybody to speak? No. What instance does he specifically cite in that moment, this commander? There was this guy that came from Egypt. Right? And so he doesn't want that situation again. So there's always these kind of revolts, always things against this Pax Romana, the Roman peace, trying to keep things, you know, copacetic. And so Paul, again, kind of using almost his citizenship here, using his status to be allowed to speak. And when Paul is given a moment to speak, what does he say? What does he begin to say in chapter 22? He's a Jew. Hey, I'm one of you guys, right? Brethren and fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you. And when they heard that he was addressing them in Hebrew dialect, what did the commander ask before? Do you know Greek? Do you know Greek? He said, yeah, but I'm not going to use that. I'm not going to use Greek. I'm going to speak to my brethren. I'm going to speak to their heart language. I'm going to use the Hebrew, obviously. And so he begins to teach and speak in the Hebrew dialect, and begins to talk about who he was, where he's from, about, again, his conversion and what was going on. They know these kind of things. And so, again, he begins to teach them. And then he said, to me, Jesus talking to Paul, verse 21, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." They listened to him up to this statement. We're good. We're good up until you start including the Gentiles. Which, what has been the issue with the church from the very beginning? What was the problem that they had to have letters written about specifically, that they had to have a kind of a group meeting that's come together on what's going on with the Gentiles? What are we going to do with these Gentiles? It was clear that the Old Testament prophesied that they'd be in on this, but made clearer still when Jesus is saying, yes, they are in on this salvation thing. And so here the Hebrew people are like, no, we're listening to you. We'll listen to you until you mention the Gentiles, which is what his ministry was about. His ministry was to the Gentiles. That's who he was sent to. And so, of course, he was going to mention that. And so this throws up an uproar, and he is taken into custody. And then Paul, later on, is going before this Roman tribune, and they kind of figure things out, what's going on with him. And then he goes to the Jewish council, and which is always fun, right? Paul before the Sanhedrin, they gave him a, you know, little place to sit, pitcher of water and that kind of stuff, and they began to talk. Not at all, obviously, right? What do they do right off the bat? They slap him in the face. And how did Paul respond to that? He turned the other cheek, right? What did he say? God's going to strike you down, you whitewashed wall. Okay. Do you sit and try me according to the law, and in violation of the law order me to be struck? What is he calling out? Their hypocrisy. Whitewashed tombs full of dead men's bones is what he's alluding to. And so he's like, God's going to strike you down. He turned the other cheek, but it wasn't without a word of education, right? He was educating them. And so he educated them on their demise if they didn't turn things around. What does he say about them listening? They're not listening, right? They don't listen. And so anyway, he goes on to talk about what happens there. The plot against Paul is foiled. Again, trying to kill Paul. What happened? Who were these conspirators? What did they say they would do in relationship to trying to kill Paul? Verse 12 and 13. I'm not going to eat. I'm not going to drink until I've killed this guy. That's pretty serious, right? You don't take. First of all, your oaths were more serious back then than they are now. Oaths are kind of like whatever, but back then an oath was a much more important thing. And to even say, I'm not going to eat or drink until I get this guy killed, until this guy's dead, is pretty, pretty bad. I don't think you've had anybody saying that about you. I think the relationship was a little bit off if somebody's saying this about you, right? And so they bound this themselves under not just an oath, but under a solemn oath. And so that they're trying to kill Paul. What do we know from the rest of this event? So there were how many of these guys that bound themselves? 40 people. If they bound them to this oath, there were 40 guys that got really skinny, right? Because were they successful in killing Paul in that moment? No, the nephew, Paul's nephew, told the commanders about what's going on. And what's interesting is that they took this one, the threat, very seriously, and they rushed Paul up to Caesarea. And so Paul goes to Caesarea. Now he's going to be here for a few years in Caesarea. So in these few chapters, he's here for a while. And Paul is escorted to Caesarea. He has quite an escort. What kind of escort does he have going up there? Who's rolling in his entourage? 200 soldiers, mounted people. He's on a mount also. 200 spearmen. Yeah. So he goes up to Felix. And a letter goes with him. From the commander there, and basically asking him to be involved in what's going on with him, to discern what's going on. And so the Jews, the leaders of the Jews, are supposed to come up and bring somebody, have this court kind of session, get him out of Jerusalem, because it's too crazy going on in Jerusalem. Let's get him in a neutral location, and let's talk this out like rational people, right? And so they go up there according to their orders. And so then, of course, the high priest Ananias come down with elders in chapter 24, and they begin to speak. And so Paul is before Felix, and he begins to talk to them about what's going on. The government nodded for him to speak, and Paul responded, "Knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense." Okay. So when the people, this lawyer begins talking to Felix, he says, "Since we have through you attained much peace," and this is verse 3, "much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for our nation, we acknowledge this in every way and in everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness, but that I may not weary you any further, I beg you to grant us by your kindness a brief hearing." What is he saying when he's doing all that? He's talking to Felix. What is he doing? Yeah, you got to buy. Like, everything is good. We're good. You've done great for us. We love you. You know, can I get your autograph when we're done with this kind of thing? But there's this guy, right? There's this guy. What is their commentary of Paul in verse 5? Spreading sedition. "For we have found this man a real pest," is what this version says. "And a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And he even tried to desecrate the temple and then we arrested him, right? And so what are they trying? So we go in and we talk to Felix, and hey, Felix, it's been a long time. How you doing? You're awesome. Thanks. And then this guy's the fly in the ointment, right? Just messing things up for everybody, this guy here. He's just a real pest, this guy. And are all these accusations true? Is he the one stirring up issue and dissension? No, by no means. Paul's not the one doing it. It's these guys, right? And all their minions. They're the ones that are stirring up the problems. They're the ones that are getting the people rallied up against him. They're the ones, men and brethren, let's attack him in Jerusalem, right? Come to our aid, let's attack. They're the ones calling this battle cry against Paul, right? And so it's so, as humans, have we changed much? No, that still happens today. These pesky Christians are trying to change our government, blah, 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 blah. Are we doing that? No. Okay, anyway, we're getting off topic. Go and stay on what's supposed to be on here. Stop it, Josh. All right. Paul is imprisoned. He's imprisoned for some time, and it's actually even a changing of the guard as far as who is in charge. But it's interesting that in chapter 24, where does it say? Verse 22, but Felix, having a more excellent, exact knowledge about the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias, the commander, comes down, I will decide your case. So what is he saying in verse 22? Having a more exact knowledge about the way. Felix. What's that? I'm sorry, I couldn't.
Church.
About the church, yes. What was the church called at one point? The way. The way. Having a more exact knowledge about the way. So Felix is not ignorant concerning these things that Paul is talking about. And so he was kept in custody. But his friends were able to come and minister to him, even though he was in custody. And so now Festus arrives in the province. This is not Uncle Festus. But Festus arrives in the province 3 days later and went up to Jerusalem. And he comes down. Requesting concession against Paul that he might have him brought to Jerusalem. And so he actually ends up speaking with Festus. And then, let's go over, we got very little time. Verse 26. We'll bring it in verse 23. So on the next day, when Agrippa came together, Bernice amid a great pomp. If we say great pomp, what are we talking about? It's yes, there's a lot of pomp and circumstance in being involved in what's going on with Agrippa, because this is King Agrippa. This is no small man. And so Paul was brought in. Festus said, King Agrippa and all you gentlemen here present with us, you see this man about whom all the people of the Jews appealed to me, both at Jerusalem and here, loudly declaring that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, right? And so, chapter 26, Paul begins to speak to Agrippa. What's interesting, I think, Paul then stretched out his hand and proceeded to make his defense. Right. This is the second time it mentions Paul doing that kind of gesture in him speaking and making a defense. And so he begins to make his defense again here to Agrippa, and so things don't exactly go the way they probably should, as far as almost persuaded, but it's interesting how he was able to speak to almost every class of people. If you think about who his audiences have been, who has he been speaking to that we've looked at so far in his life? A lot of Jews, Greeks, slave and free. Right? Men and women of every class, even kings now. So he has been a mouthpiece for God across the board as far as being a messenger for God. And so it's interesting that he was able to do all these different things. So he's before Agrippa. Verse 30. The king stood up, and the governor and Bernice and those who were sitting with him, and they had gone aside. They began talking on to one another, saying, this man is not doing anything worthy of death or imprisonment. And Agrippa said to Festus, this man might have been set free had he not appealed to Caesar. What does it mean to appeal to Caesar? He had a right, yes. And if you look back, where is it? I lost it. Yes. Verse 21. But when Paul appealed to be held in custody for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be kept in custody. And so he was appealed to Caesar. Is this, he has a right as a Roman citizen. What was happening was that Festus was not handling the situation very well. And those who were there were not handling the situation very well. He could see that things were going bad for him, that he was eventually going to be sent back to Jerusalem because they didn't really want to deal with him. And that's not where he wanted to go. Where did he want to go? Rome. Let's go to Rome, right? He wants to go to Rome. And so he makes this appeal to Caesar. What's interesting, this word that's used here in this appeal is the same word that's used when they talk about calling on the name of the Lord. It's the same word. It's the same word. And so it's when you say calling on the name of the Lord, you're making appeal based on the name of the Lord and his authority. And in this situation, he's appealing to, he has the right as a Roman citizen to make this appeal, to get his case heard. And so they discuss whether or not that's possible, and he makes this appeal. And they say in chapter 25 that, or rather 26, this man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. Was Paul's life about his freedom? Was he worried about his freedom? No, he was set on the work that he wanted to do. He wanted to go to Rome. And what better way to travel if the government's going to pay for it, right? And so in this situation, they have to make obligation to get him to Rome to hear, be heard. And so chapter 27 begins this kind of journey. After he's been in Caesarea Philippi for several years, he is sent to Rome. Is his Rome just an easy cruise? Is it a leisure cruise to Rome? What happens in transition to Rome? Shipwreck. I mean, this guy can't catch a break, right? I mean, it's like... But what's interesting about this chapter and about this shipwreck, this is one of the most detailed accounts of sailing on the Mediterranean Ocean in the first century that we have history in any document, in any historical document currently in writing. This is one of the most detailed accounts of traveling on the Mediterranean Ocean. Thank you, Luke, right? So again, it's very cool, all the details that are involved in this, and how, and some of you know about sailing. They talk about throwing out paddles, but you have the anchor, like the tarp, the kite anchor for the current. What do you call that, guys? What's that? Like a drag line, so it's like this giant sail under the water to slow you down because the wind's pushing you, but you don't want to go that fast, so you get more drag. Because what was going on is if they had kept getting pushed, they'd get on the sandbars off the coast of Africa. And they didn't want to be on a sandbar. If you've, you know, it was not the kind of sandbar we have around here. They did not want to get on that sandbar because you're not getting off, and you shall surely die. So they were trying to make concessions for that. Also, Paul was getting information from God about, hey, you guys need to stay here, right? Don't go anywhere. And what did the captain say? No, we're good, right? And it talks about using the islands, like going to the lee side of the island and trying to make port, and that wasn't a good port to winter. They weren't really supposed to be traveling during that time. And the odds are the grain was short during that period of time in Rome. And so they're trying to get a shipment of grain, probably. There's some money to be made. You've got a boat full of grain, possibly. There's some money to be made if there's a grain shortage in Rome. So what are you trying to do? If you're the captain and the owner of the boat is also on, and they want that money, right? We're gonna take some risks to make sure we get there and get paid for this cargo. And they leave, and Paul's like, we shouldn't leave, right? And so they go on, and they are doing everything they can to stay afloat. They're even it's what's called frapping, where they've thrown everything overboard, and they've taken and actually wrapped really strong cords around the hull of the ship, because the ship itself was in danger of coming apart. And so they mention that as well. And then Paul begins to tell them, hey, we've been in this thing for a while. We've not seen the sun for a while. Are you guys ready to listen to me? And kind of at that point, they said, yeah. I said, everybody needs to stay on the boat, and I am confident that God will see us through, that no one will die. And so that ends up being the case. They are shipwrecked, but they do come up on the ocean or up on the land. During this time, what happens when they're making a fire on land, and what happens? Chapter 28, we're skipping ahead here. Chapter 28, have you guys ever gone out and gathered wood to make a fire when you're camping? Anybody? Some of you are like, you're crazy, I would never. You don't do that in a hotel, that's the kind of camping I do, no. So he's gathering wood, and he throws it on the fire, and what happens? Chapter 28. A snake bites him. Now, if bad luck happens, if bad things happen to you, what are people going to say? You're cursed, right? Right. Now, the natives, what do we see about the natives? The natives showed us extraordinary kindness, for because of the rain that had set, because of the cold, they kindled a fire and received us all. He gathered a bundle of sticks, laid them on the fire. A viper came out because of the heat and fastened himself to his hand. It wasn't that he like just bit him, it's like kind of tagged him. It like suction cupped to his hand. And it even goes on to say it was on his hand. And the native saw the creature hanging from his hand. So it was kind of one of those, apparently, snake on hand. Paul goes, huh, look at that. And you know, so people see that, and how do they respond? They saw the creature hanging from his hand and began to say to one another, undoubtedly this guy, because they're all what? He's a murderer. Like, you don't travel with a Roman escort unless you're not, like, this is a prison escort, right? So he must be a really bad person. He's a murderer. He's a murderer. But then what happens? However, verse 5, he swatted away like it was a mosquito, right? Shook off the creature off into the fire, which, you know, any of us would have done, right? He did not let him live. He shook it off into the fire, which is biblical evidence that what? It's all right to kill snakes. Okay, so, but they were expecting that he was about, so he gets bitten by a snake, and everybody's watching him, right? Because there's nothing else to do. You're sitting around a fire. It's raining outside. Let's see if this guy dies. Is he swelling up? Is he blowing up? How's he going to react to this? What happens? Doesn't even swell up. He gets bored. Everybody gets bored very quickly. You know, people probably lost some bets. But in this situation, he does not die. And how does their opinion change? He was a god. But after they had waited a long time, and then nothing unusual happened to him, they changed their minds and began to say he was a god. That was quick, you know. So there wasn't a lot going on. So they wintered there. And then verse 11, Paul arrives in Rome, and we see what happens with Paul in Rome. What happens? The brethren come to him, and verse 15, and the brethren, when they had heard about this, oh man, okay, we don't have time. All right, so he's in Rome, and he's there a while. It finishes off where he's under house arrest in Rome. Verse 30, he stayed 2 full years in his own rented quarters, was welcoming all who came to him, preaching the kingdom of God, teaching concerning the Lord Jesus Christ with all openness, unhindered. So that's his situation when he's in Rome at that time, right? He's there 2 years. That's where things end off. So does Paul go to Spain? We have no biblical evidence necessarily that Paul went to Spain. The only time people tried, well, he was unhindered. That doesn't mean he could go anywhere, but he was unhindered during that time period while he was in Rome. But there's other extra biblical stuff outside of the Bible that talks about him going to Spain. Clement of Rome, remember we talked about Clement earlier? He mentions Clement as being a faithful worker. It's possible it's the same Clement of Rome that writes about him. So here he talks about him being this true companion, and Philippians chapter 4, verse 3, mentioning Clement. So it's possible it's the same Clement. There were several Clements. And what does Clement say about Paul and his travels? Says, because of his jealousy and strife, Paul, by his example, pointed out the way to the prize for a patient endurance, which Paul is a great example of patient endurance. After he had been 7 times in chains and had been driven into exile, had been stoned, had preached in the east and in the west, he won the genuine glory of his faith, having taught the righteousness of the whole world, having reached the farthest limits of the west, which includes Spain. So he mentions here that he went to the farthest limits of the west, which includes Spain. So he's not, and then others also mention this later on. So, but what's interesting about this is look at the date. This is in the 70s-ish, so when this was written. So this is during life. He knew, possibly knew Paul when this was written. So he would have been an authority on that if he went that far. He didn't specifically mention Spain, but others go on to mention that he went to Spain as well. So these all mention that according to tradition, he went to Spain. Whether or not he went to Spain, it doesn't change anything that we have. It's interesting to look at. So here are the letters that Paul wrote and what time they were written and where they were written from. Galatians could have been in several different places. That's why it's in two different places. Also, depending on if he did go to. Because the thing is, if he went to Spain, he came back to Rome and was in Roman prison again. And in imprisonment, and that's when he possibly wrote 2 Timothy. But if he never left there, then it was written during that earlier time period. Because Paul, as far as writing Hebrews, you see hard dates there at 67. May or may not have written Hebrews. We don't have any evidence that he did or didn't, but that's a possibility. But as far as his death is concerned, Eusebius writes about this. It says, after defending himself and the apostles, was again set on the ministry of preaching. So he's talking about him going out again, coming a second time to the same city, talking about Rome, suffered martyrdom under Nero. And under his imprisonment, he wrote the second epistle of Timothy, is what he's writing there. And so he was beheaded. So Paul, being a Roman citizen, would not have been crucified. He would have been beheaded, and traditionally he was beheaded outside the city. And that during that same time, Peter was crucified, because we're blaming everything on the Christians, and let's give the people what they want, let's kill some Christians and make everybody happy. And so that's tradition about the death of Paul. And so we finish off with 2 Timothy 4, 6 through 8, and his comments. Was he ready? Yeah, he says, for I am already being poured out. If you read that a little bit slowly, for I am already to be poured out, right? I'm ready. When you read this text, he's ready to go, right? And so this was his kind of last letter that was written in the life of Paul. And he is a great example of consistent persistence in the face of danger, in the face of opposition, in the face of all these different kind of things, in the face of getting stoned. He was a great example to us. But any other thoughts, questions, comments before we finish up class? Thank you very much for your time this morning. I appreciate it.